Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the appointment by Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein of former FBI Director Robert Mueller as a special prosecutor to oversee the Russian investigation and examine the possibility that the memo that Congress is now demanding about Comey's Oval Office meeting with Trump, at which the FBI director was allegedly asked by the president to back off the investigation into Michael Flynn, is the first shot across the bow, and that Comey has a number of incriminating memos that could be leaked incrementally, revealing even more explosive details of an amateurish and dysfunctional presidency. A former intelligence operative, Malcolm Nance, the author of The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election, joins us to discuss the president's remarks today at a Coast Guard ceremony where he avoided any mention of the Comey memo but portrayed himself as a victim of the press and other unnamed forces that are out to destroy his presidency. We will assess the gathering storm engulfing a chaotic presidency and how long the few adults like General McMaster and General Mattis will allow themselves to be used as props making excuses for a commander-in-chief who increasingly is making it obvious that he is dangerously out of his depth. Then we'll get a different perspective from the growing assumption that Trump is heading for impeachment and speak with Mark Perry, an author and historian specializing in military foreign affairs and intelligence analysis. He joins us to discuss the possibility that a constitutional crisis could be averted by helping the president succeed rather than feeding into Trump's combative impulses. And we'll also look into his article at Politico, Why Americans Don't Win Wars Anymore, that makes it clear we should be spending less on the military and more on combating ignorance at home. Then finally, we'll examine whether the political and cultural divide in the country can be bridged and speak with Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and the author of Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. He joins us from a blue island in a deeply red state, and we will discuss how the information that the mainstream media reveals daily about Trump's disastrous presidency does not penetrate the Fox Sinclair megachurch bubble that Trump's supporters inhabit. And joining us now is Malcolm Nance, a globally recognized counterterrorism expert and intelligence community member who has been deployed to intelligence operations in the Balkans, Middle East, and sub-Saharan Africa. He's the author of An End to Al-Qaeda, The Terrorists of Iraq, Defeating ISIS, Who They Are, How They Fight, What They Believe, and his latest book is The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Elections. Welcome to Background Briefing, Malcolm Nance.
It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you, Malcolm. And it's pretty hard to keep up with Donald Trump. I did a program yesterday with Ali Soufan talking about what is alleged to have happened in the Oval Office with the Russian foreign minister and Kislyak, the top Russian spy, the ambassador. And under normal circumstances, that would be a very current, relevant interview. And and lo and behold, Malcolm, today the same thing almost happened to us. Here we're just learning now that Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein has appointed former FBI Director Robert Mueller to serve as a special prosecutor to oversee the investigation into the Russian influence in the 2016 presidential election. So, it's really hard to keep up with Trump.
You know, I know. I'd really just like one day off. If it wasn't just from the Twitter, just from the news itself. But as we're seeing here with this late news, with the Deputy Attorney General now has directly injected himself into this, and he is now going to see that a career FBI man, Robert Mueller, is going to now find out what is going on in this case with the President of the United States, with the FBI, and all other actions related to the, Donald Trump's comment the other day where we had the impression that there was an obstruction of justice. This is now serious. We are at Watergate-level scandal at this point. And Donald Trump's legacy in the first, I believe we're at 118 days, is going nine times faster than Richard Nixon's.
And you're on MSNBC all the time trying to keep up with this stuff. So what's your sense of this runaway train?
Well, it's exactly that. It's a runaway train. You have a president of the United States who thinks that, he's Ray Liotta and Joe Pesci combined from the movie Goodfellas, who thinks that, can run the government as he ran a real estate conglomerate, just ordering people about and doing as he sees fit. And I don't know whether he learned quite a bit from his mafia friends in the New York City construction business, but I think he took the director of the FBI and thought that he could just cajole him and order him to do things, which if you look at the history of James Comey, his entire career, that is the last thing that man's going to do. He is a straight shooter. He's a Boy Scout. And, you know, even though he got involved in politics last year, the one thing he will not do is accept intimidation against to shut down a counter espionage investigation. And that is the investigation that Donald Trump wants ended. And that is serious. It implies that there's certainly a lot more information that we don't know about. And any president of the United States who thinks that he can turn off what could be a probe of Americans who are in league with foreign intelligence officers, this is not going to end well.
Well, but the Russian story from the Oval Office indicates to me, I don't know whether you've ever heard the audio tape of Donald Trump pretending to be his own PR man, calling himself John Barron.
Right.
This guy
John
was,
Barron, yeah.
Yeah, he was totally immersed in that celebrity, gossipy, tabloid world. That's what interested him. Now you have that same person in the White House who's able to brag to the Russians, I get the greatest intel, like I get the latest gossip. I'm sure he goes around on the golf course telling his buddies about, you know, the most sensitive secrets the U.S. has, because that's his mindset. I don't think there's any discipline there. I don't think there's any barriers between his old world and this new one that he's in. It's just like, wow, this is great. I'm getting some great intel.
Well, you're right. And I'm certain that he does that. So, you know, some presidents do that. They reveal information to, you know, usually senators or congressmen that they need to move on a particular piece of legislation. But a new word has been introduced into our vocabulary with Donald Trump with regards to management and operation of the government, and that's guardrails. And Donald Trump appears to have no guardrails. He is constantly going over the cliff. And it appears that his staff are always surprised. There is no check or balance for him, outside of his own, you know, inability to Twitter at any particular time. So he disregards all norms of the United States government, and he seems to have a contempt for how America has been run, or he has a ignorance that is so deep and so profound that he doesn't care. And I suspect that he's lived his whole life like that.
Well, today, before the Coast Guard graduates at the Coast Guard Academy in Connecticut, he basically took the tack, which is definitely working with his base, and that is that the press is out to get me in the deep state. He didn't mention the deep state by name, but he implied that I'm going to stand up. I'm not going to let them win. And, you know, I think it would be very dangerous in many ways, because that narrative works with his people. They think, you know, he's the savior, and that they liberal elite did him in. All you have to do is watch Fox News. That's their message, you know, that it's not that not that Trump's incompetent, that he's prevented from doing what he wants to do and what we want him to do by this amorphous thing in Washington, whatever they call it, you know, the deep state or the liberal establishment or the liberal elite or whatever. So that's what worries me, because I think that Comey's got Trump by the whatever, I can't, cojones, I guess I can use that word without the FCC mm-hmm. coming down on me. The fact is that I think that Comey has far more memos than the one that has just been released leaked through the New York Times. And my sense is that these memos are probably increasingly incriminating and more explosive, and that we could have a drip, 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 because Trump has declared war on Comey. He's called him a showboater, etc., and fired him, and I think that we're in for a rocky road. What's your interpretation of where we stand?
Well, I agree with you 100%, and I believe that Comey's memo was most likely the least explosive of all of them, and a shot across Trump's bow to let him know that these documents exist. And you might recall that Trump claimed that he had tape recordings or hinted that, you know, that Comey should be careful that he didn't have recordings of these things. Well, that would be awesome right now. And it would certainly tell us who is telling the truth. But Trump has bluffed and played this game throughout his entire career. And this is just, he is just not understanding the playing field that he's on. This is not like trying to hustle some lower district court judge or some, you know, deputy assistant district attorney in southern Manhattan. This is where he is going to meet the wall, and he believes that he has total and utter impunity to do whatever he wants. He hinted in one of the conversations that maybe we should start arresting journalists. As if it was a true possibility, not that it was some wild fantasy that no one should entertain. He's an unbridled, spoiled child, as it's been characterized in the media this week. And a temper tantrum from him could cost people their lives. I mean, I'm asked every day, is there a possibility that he could suddenly shift and attempt to divert and go to war somewhere, like, you know, finally provoke North Korea or carry out in a strike? It's also been said to me that he views everything through the prism of his own personal ego. There is nothing that he is satisfying for his family, for his friends, not even money. It's all about his own ego and how he sees himself, not how the world sees him. He lives in a bubble. So, you know, there is always that possibility, and it's terrible to think of it, that he could decide, and he has hinted that, you know, atomic weapons are viable tools, and he would want to be the first person to use one since Harry Truman. And that you know, I at this point, I would have to make that a viable possibility, that he would think that the only way out of this impasse that he gets, that if it goes deeper and if the talk of impeachment continues, is that he will do something rash.
And again, I'm speaking with Malcolm Nance, a globally recognized counterterrorism expert and intelligence community member who's been deployed to intelligence operations in the Balkans, Middle East, and sub-Saharan Africa. His latest book is The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election. So what then, you've got McMaster and you've got Mattis, you've got a couple of adults there. Apparently you don't know how much he listens to them, whether, you know, he listens to Alex Jones as much as he listens to McMaster. It's quite possible that that's the case. But I don't know how long these guys, I know McMaster must have been really uncomfortable having to do cleanup for Trump the other day by suggesting he hadn't exposed sources and methods, when we learned, in fact, that he had, that they'd mentioned the town where this supposedly Israeli asset is, and that's putting his or her life in danger. So the question would be then, and by the way, his first intelligence briefing came from the State Department during the transition, and apparently these State Department briefers were just terrified. They gave him a sort of, tried to give him a round robin about how the world looks, and all he wanted to talk about, what would happen is a nuclear weapon hit New York. And they thought, good Lord, this is scary. So you're right about that. He has made some remarks about nuclear weapons that are scary as hell. But given that possibility, is there a firewall? Is there some way that he could be prevented? Like, remember when Nixon was getting drunk, when Watergate was getting to him, Al Haig told everybody to ignore what was happening, you know?
Right.
Don't take the call.
Unfortunately. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, during one part of my career, I worked at, I pulled temporary duty at a National Nuclear Command Post built into the side of a mountain, you know, a mile deep, and where they have a continuity of government facility, which shows, you know, the House on one side, the Senate on the other side, President in a big atrium, and they run a full-scale simulated atomic attack on the United States for all newcomers. Just to show you how crazy it gets, and for you to realize that there's nothing outside of the building, you know, of the, you know, the mountain that you're in, and you immediately become an ardent anti-nuke. Every military person was anti-nuke. For people who don't know it or understand it, This is it's almost like a very, very big firecracker. Donald Trump has the entire resources of the United States government at his fingertips. He could ask the people from Los Alamos to come in to explain it. Any number of experts at the Pentagon or the Department of Energy, which is now, you know, led by, you know, the former governor of Texas, Perry, and to explain and show him just what would happen. But that's not how he thinks. He thinks like a five-year-old, and his worldview is wrapped up in the immediate moment. You know, there's that effect of when an object is, you know, blocked from in front of a baby, that it disappears from their universe. And I think Trump is a poorly developed person, and outside of his own person, his own ego, his own whims and his own desires. I don't believe that he has anyone's interest in mind other than the people who elected him into office. And so long as he gets that adulation, I think he'll be relatively manageable. But General Mattis, General McMaster, who has just been horribly discredited and badly damaged to the point where they trotted him out the other day, and flat out no one accepted what he said as true, because he is now tied at the hip with Donald Trump. And so long as it comes out of Donald Trump's White House, it cannot be believed. But that's the effect of what happens when you have a pathological liar.
Right.
And in the position of commander-in-chief.
Right. And all of that decades of credibility that guy's built up. I mean, he's now it's roadkill like Sean Spicer, right?
Yeah. And Rob Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general.
Mm-hmm.
The minute they acquiesce to a person who is clearly, clearly out of his depth. And I believe McMaster is doing this simply because he was an active duty general. He has been ordered, and therefore he is trying to maintain good order and discipline in the ship of state. And I think he believes that he is there to keep the president steady. And as we've also seen in reporting, Donald Trump does not like that. He says he calls McMaster a pain. He doesn't like the idea that he gets more attention than him. And I think he has a contempt that for McMaster's actually having an entire life of experience that he never had. And with that, he always has that, so to speak, Trump card, which is that he's president and he can order anyone with more experience around. I think that gives him his greatest satisfaction.
Right. Two scoops of ice cream and two nukes. I mean, it's crazy. But I believe you're absolutely correct, Malcolm Nance, that I think McMaster's in there, and I think a lot of people, I know he met with Brent Scowcroft when he first got the job, and Brent told him to try and take charge, and he's doing the best he can because you need an adult there. It's an unenviable position, and we need this guy, but we need more of them. But at the same time, it doesn't sound like it's enough. And so what do you think is going to happen here in terms of his own people in the bubble? I don't know what you can do to convince them that this guy's incompetent and dangerous and that they have made a mistake. What about the Republican Congress? They've been craven so far. Do you think they're going to step up and do the right thing? Because I really think this comes down to kind of some fundamental patriotism here.
Well, it does come down to patriotism, and now is the time that they're going to have to choose who they stand for. Do they stand for the nation, or do they stand for Donald Trump? And they are not the same thing. Unfortunately, I think that a lot of people are seeing so much chaff in the air, so much drama, as Mitch McConnell put it, that they are starting to lose track of what the story is. And I actually had a journalist from England call me and ask me, you know, which one of these stories is more important. Well, it's important to recognize that this is all one story. And that story is the story of the Russian hacking of the Democratic National Committee last year and their cyber warfare attack on the United States electorate. Everything stems from that. But Donald Trump's obsequiousness towards Russia, his almost slavish devotion towards Vladimir Putin, all of this is of the same story, and why Russia carried out the hack, why Michael Flynn carried out the communications he did with the Russian ambassador, why all of these individuals are being investigated by the nation's spy hunters. This is all one story. And the latest shoe to drop is that we now know Donald Trump tried to kill this story. And in trying to kill a counter-espionage investigation, he has essentially done the first act of impeachment, which is to commit obstruction of justice. And some people say that there, you know, there isn't an active investigation going on in which justice was obstructed. Well, there is. It's secret because it involves the nation's spy hunters, and it involves American citizens who may have been in active league or communication with Russian intelligence officers. It's as serious as it has ever been in the history of the United States, at least since 1780, when Benedict Arnold was sought after trying to give away West Point. We could have the greatest espionage scandal in American history since the revolution occurring right now.
Well, Malcolm Nance, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure to be here.
And again, I've been speaking with Malcolm Nance, who's a globally recognized counterterrorism expert and intelligence community member who's been deployed to intelligence operations in the Balkans, Middle East, and sub-Saharan Africa. And his latest book is The Plot to Hack America, How Putin's Cyber Spies and WikiLeaks Tried to Steal the 2016 Election. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back with a different perspective on the growing assumption that Trump is heading for impeachment. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Mark Perry, an author and historian specializing in military, foreign affairs, and intelligence analysis. His books include Conceived in Liberty, and his latest book is Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies. He's the recipient of both the 1995 National Jewish Book Award and the prestigious Project Censored Award. And his most recent article, Politico, is Why Americans Don't Win Wars Anymore. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Perry.
Good to be here.
And Mark, given that you're an historian of intelligence, it does seem that we are entering an era now where Donald Trump is, based upon his speech today before the Coast Guard Academy, is more or less sort of setting himself up as a victim of the deep state, that not only the press are going to do him in, but the intelligence world will also do him in, and that he's going to fight back and never give in. Do you think that there is a war between the White House and the deep state?
I'm a skeptic of the whole idea of a deep state. I mean, there's no question that if the president were to tomorrow morning not be president and Congress were not to meet, somehow the government would continue to chug on. There's no doubt about that. There are lifelong career people who run the American government who are not elected by anybody. But the idea that somehow there's a plot or a conspiracy or even meetings to kind of undo the president strikes me as almost naive. It doesn't happen. Earlier today when you and I talked, I was thinking through this a little bit, and I noticed to myself that when George W. Bush, Bush 43, came into office and really imposed a new way of thinking about foreign policy, one that I was not a fan of, the government turned on a dime. The careerists in the State Department and the intelligence agency really shifted to meet the needs and the thinking of the new president. And that can happen now. The president has enormous constitutional power if he knows how to how to use it. So this idea that there's kind of a deep state that is at war with Donald Trump and that we're in the middle of some kind of intergovernmental civil war strikes me as pretty superficial.
But he's a different president in the sense that, first of all, I don't see that he has much credibility because he says the most outrageous things. And, for example, his press secretary, who's obviously very beleaguered and might well be fired soon, Sean Spicer, he was literally sent out on his first day as the press secretary, as the spokesman for the president of the United States, to lie about the size of the inauguration crowd in a way that was just ludicrous. So they haven't gotten off to a good start in terms of credibility, surely.
Well, you're absolutely right, and I take your point and agree with it. The problem here isn't that Donald Trump has new and different and revolutionary ideas that the rest of us are having trouble adopting. The problem here is that the President of the United States, the man we elected, doesn't seem to have any ideas at all. And the question isn't one of, you know, our dislike of him because he represents something new and different. Our worry is that he's not competent. And that's an entirely different problem than an evil guy who's engaged in high crimes and misdemeanors. It's quite possible that Donald Trump fired James Comey without knowing the firestorm it would cause, that he just kind of shrugged off the Michael Flynn problem with Russia, that, you know, that he's acting like a normal American. That is to say, we don't get up in the morning and call a lawyer and have him escort us around all day to figure out, you know, what to say and what to do and what's right and what's wrong and what's legal and what's not. But that is, in many respects, what a president has to do. He has to be very careful, has to be very mindful of the law, and has to be aware that, you know, of the special interests that are involved here. And Donald Trump doesn't have any of that. He doesn't have any sense of that. That's a problem.
But interesting enough, when you just mentioned that, I thought, well, you know, his supporters out there don't think that there is a problem. They think that all this is inside the Beltway hysteria and the liberal media all in a lather, and that he's doing a great job, and they love him.
Yeah, I think it's. I know this is going to sound odd, maybe, and people will shake their heads at my lack of good information. But it's quite possible that Donald Trump will survive this crisis, and that he'll run for president in 4 years and be reelected. There's still deep mistrust of Washington, of what people call the elites, of the established government bureaucracy, and people really want something new. And people might question Mr. Trump's competence, as I do, but he's certainly something new. And he gained strength through ad hoc attacks and, you know, the idea that he somehow colluded with the Russians to, and if he hadn't, Hillary Clinton would be president. I mean, it's just not true. On the face of it, doesn't make any sense. The person who lost the election was Hillary Clinton. The Democratic Party nominated the wrong person. That's why Donald Trump's president. Not because, you know, anybody paid attention to what the Russians were saying. Quite the opposite. So it's, you know, we are obviously in a very tenuous and dangerous position as a country. But this is a crisis in many respects of our own making.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Perry, who is an author and historian specializing in military, foreign affairs, and intelligence analysis. His latest book is Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies. And his most recent article at Politico is Why Americans Don't Win Wars Anymore. We'll get to the not winning wars anymore, but in terms of his competence or lack of competence, if his supporters are going to stick with him, and he made an appeal to them today, clearly, at the Coast Guard Academy. I'm going to fight on, and that the press are out to get me, and they hate the press at any rate. And I can, you know, quote you the latest Washington Post ABC poll. 89% of Trump supporters believe he's honest and trustworthy and will fulfill his campaign promises, and 78% of them believe that the mainstream media propagates fake news. So those are the alternative universes that we're dealing with here. But stuck in the middle is the Republican Congress. And how long do you think they're going to stick with him? Because he's making life uncomfortable for them, clearly.
Yes, he is. And it's a really good question. I wish I had a definite answer. I think that it's very clear that his support among the Republican leadership is eroding. But they're also looking at, over their shoulder at this Washington Post poll and saying 89% of Trump supporters still support him. I think that maybe we're dealing with larger questions. I think that if Trump were to be forced from office, that would be, you know, people would be very satisfied and relieved that we don't, you know, Mike Pence is at least competent, but it would be a disaster for the country. It would absolutely alienate a large section of the populace who thought, well, you know, you can vote for somebody, and if you don't vote for who they want, the deep state or whoever, then they're gone. And the factor of alienating a large portion of the American public is something that I think that we ought to recoil from. Removing Trump from office is not a great idea. Helping him, if that's possible, and is the other alternative, you know, that we have. There aren't many people willing to do that, but there's a lot at stake here, including whether, you know, how we answer the question, is the United States now capable of governing itself or not? That's the real question. And the answer that I come up with, watching what's going on, is apparently not.
Well, but it seems to be a deeper problem, though. When you talk about Trump not being competent, which is pretty manifestly clear, there's also, and I think you can make the case that John McCain changed our politics by selecting Sarah Palin as his running mate, and she was clearly not competent. But the reason that I think they get support, both Trump and Palin, is that there is a kind of distrust of elites and a distrust of expertise. I mean, that explains these anti-vaxxers, you know, and all of these conspiracies out there just that are anti-intellectual, anti-science. There's a lot of traction, and not to mention the fact that I think almost half of the population don't believe in evolution. So I guess my question would be, what will it take for Trump's people to recognize that he's just not up for the job?
Well, you bring up a good point, and I was going to mention it before. I'm glad you did. Tom Nichols in Foreign Affairs had a piece recently about the mistrust of experts and what that means. And I mean, I saw it firsthand. I had to travel for family reasons to Florida last week and sat down with people who were Trump supporters, and, you know, they're citing Judge Judy as a source for their beliefs, and how MS-13 is a Muslim gang, which it's not, because that's what they heard. And just, you kind of scratch your head at this. I mean, this is a huge problem, and, you know, family after family across this country have these arguments every night, I'm sure. You know, what are we going to do? What are we going to do about it? And it's going to take a while. It shows, I think, how our educational system has deteriorated. In the short term, I think the best that we can do, and what I try to do, is to just stand up and say, no, that's not the case. And argue it out. But we still have a requirement to listen to people who have different views. And we can't assume that just because, you know, New York, Philadelphia, Boston, and L.A. voted for Hillary Clinton that the country is progressive. We don't live in a progressive country. We live in a very conservative country. And we have to embrace that and understand it and understand that, you know, people who support Trump are, you know, they might be supporting an incompetent president, but they have a legitimate, incredible point of view. Mistrust of Washington is widespread, and there's good reason for it.
And that's clearly why he got elected. I mean, you couldn't have had a candidate that represented the status quo than Hillary Clinton, right?
Yeah, well, you know how I feel about this, and I know how you feel. I just, the way I think about this is, you know, those people who voted for Franklin Roosevelt, the poor, the workers, the small shopkeepers, the farmers, all of those people who voted for the New Deal and progressivism voted for Donald Trump this time. And all of those small shopkeepers and workers and all those people on Bunker Hill, they voted for Donald Trump. And all those on Lexington Green, they voted for Donald Trump too. The Tories, the elites, the banking community, they voted for Hillary Clinton. So, you know, when Hillary came out yesterday and said, well, I'm establishing a foundation to support progressive causes, my first thought was, well, you're not a progressive. And that to me was the real betrayal of the last election. I feel so, like many Americans who view themselves progressives, I just feel betrayed and disaffected by what's going on. but still, you know, I was still adamantly pounding the table and say, listen, this man's our president. Let's try to help him, because doing contrary to that was really going to be harmful to the country. We've had 5 months now of all the oxygen is out of the room. Nothing's been getting done, and it's going to go on. It could go on for 4 years, and the country just can't afford it.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, I wanted to talk about your article at Politico, Why Americans Don't Win Wars Anymore. Yeah. We haven't won a war since World War II, and we spend more on defense than anybody else by a factor of something, I don't know. I think we spend more on defense than the seven other countries combined, most of whom are allies. And now they're just upping it to $54 billion extra on top of what, bringing it up to about $600 billion. And $54 billion extra that Trump's asked for is the equivalent of the annual defense expenditure for Russia. So it's an amazing situation that you can keep spending more money but not really be able to even articulate the threat. I mean, we can't even figure out what to call the main enemy, which is these ragtag bunch of guys driving around in pickup trucks in the middle of the desert. You know, are they Islamic State? Are they ISIS? Are they ISIL? I mean, it doesn't seem to matter anymore whether we have an enemy or who the enemy is, and it doesn't seem to matter anymore whether we win wars.
Yeah, everything you just said, I agree with. I think that in light of our previous discussion about how people question experts and 50% of the people don't buy into evolution, it's irresponsible for the United States to be spending $630 billion on the Pentagon. It's just absolutely irresponsible. They say, well, you know, the more money, the more security. Well, that's not true. In fact, just the opposite might be true. And, you know, ISIS is a problem, but it is not going to gnaw away at the foundations of our civilization, undermine our democratic principles. It's just not. I think that what we're faced with is not winning, but this kind of, you know, good enough that the wars we fight now, so the end state will be, well, it's good enough. You know, we can't win in Afghanistan, but we can leave a stable government there and keep terrorist groups from launching attacks on us, and that's good enough. The same in Iraq and ISIS. Well, it's good enough. But I think that we have to start questioning the premises of whether these kinds of deployments overseas are a good idea to begin with. And having spent $4.75 trillion since 2001, since September 11th, and to not have won, or to not even have left in place a good enough government that would be a help to us, that's a real problem. And I think, you know, I hope that there will be a national debate. There hasn't been. There will be a national debate on whether this money is wasted and what we do, what kind of national strategy we should adopt going forward. Because this constant spending on defense just isn't working.
Right. And just to finish up, though, it would seem that if you spent maybe a sixth of that or a tenth of that, you know, $100 billion more on education, you would get over the problems that we talked about earlier, which is obviously the biggest problem we face internally is that there is no consensus anymore in this country about what is real and what is true.
That's right. And I'm sure I do what you do every night. I sit in my chair, I watch the news reports, and I just shake my head. Mm-hmm. You know, and I turn to my wife and I say, well, that's not true, or, well, that's not the whole story, or, well, you know, and it goes on and on and on, you know.
Right.
And I think that's why this time is so dangerous. You know, it's bad enough that we're threatened by nuclear missiles by Russia when we shouldn't have to be. It's that, there seems to be a kind of a sense among the American people that our national project is unraveling, and we've got to get a grip on this.
Well, Mark Perry, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Perry, who's an author and historian specializing in military foreign affairs and intelligence analysis. His latest book is Talking to Terrorists, Why America Must Engage with Its Enemies. And his most recent article, Politico, is Why Americans Don't Win Wars Anymore.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. He's the author of Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream, and Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Jensen.
Good to be with you, Ian.
Thank you, Robert. And there's very little constructive dialogue going on in the country. We are polarized and living in alternative universes. There's the universe that thinks Donald Trump is a catastrophe and is dangerous. And every day more and more stories come out indicating that that looks like it really is the case. And yet his supporters out there think he's doing a great job, think he's honest and trustworthy, think he will fulfill his campaign promises, and that they believe that the mainstream press prints fake news. And so how can we straddle this divide? At what point do you think, if indeed Trump were to be impeached, surely you'd have a revolution in this country, because his supporters would think that that was a coup by the liberal elite, surely?
Well, I'm not so sure it would be that dire if things came to that. But let's go back and take some of the points you made. The country's polarized. That's true. It's not unique. There have been periods where there was incredible political polarization in this country. Go back to the immediate aftermath of the founding and the separation and the Federalists and the Jeffersonians. A lot of fake news, a lot of created, manufactured stories in the press. Of course, the big difference is there is the United States was not the world's superpower. And so the consequences of it were not quite so dire. The other big change from previous periods, of course, is we're now on the precipice of something like a complete ecological collapse that's unfolding. So I think what's different today is not that people get a little crazy, that people support candidates irrationally. That happens on all sides and happens throughout history. It's the stakes that are different. And, of course, the nature of mass communication that accelerates this. We don't have time for the kinds of checks on insanity that seem to be part of history. So there's a lot of reasons to be concerned today. What about those supporters of Donald Trump who seem immune to factual assertions and some sort of rational assessment of the facts? Okay, I see that all the time. I see it in students here at the University of Texas. I see it in some members of my own family. That's also not unique to Trump. A lot of irrational attachment to politicians on all sides. But I really am not sure that the commitment people have to Trump would lead them to the streets if the workings of, let's say, the justice system, whether it's impeachment or investigations through traditional law enforcement agencies, if they do come up with evidence of criminal activity by Trump, I'm not so sure the country's, you know, going to be awash in blood in the streets. A lot of people who like to bark about how much they love Trump really, I don't think, believe he is honest and trustworthy. I think they're just angry at a centrist and liberal establishment that has largely ignored them. And that assessment is absolutely true. The centrist and liberal establishment has largely ignored ordinary people in this country. That's what we on the left have been saying for a long time.
But when you mentioned the dire situation vis-a-vis global warming and the fact that that the planet itself is in danger, then how do you deal with the fact that Donald Trump is actually making it even more dangerous? He's rolling back what tentative and inadequate steps have been taken to address this danger. So in that context, what he's doing is the reckless endangerment of the planet. So can you afford the luxury of basically wishing for a dialogue with the very people who are enabling the destruction of all of us? In other words, we're all in lifeboat Earth together, but there are a bunch of people in our lifeboat that are drilling holes in the bottom of the lifeboat.
Right, and here I think the news is bad on all fronts. So, you know, I have long said there's two kinds of climate change deniers in the United States. One group is housed mainly in the Republican Party, and they deny the science. The other group is housed mainly in the Democratic Party, and they deny the implications of the science. So it's true enough that if we proceed on a course charted by people like Donald Trump and James Inhofe, the main climate denier in Congress, people like my own representative here in Texas, Lamar Smith, another big climate denier, that's going to accelerate the rate of destruction and bring us closer to that edge of the cliff sooner. But let's face it, the Democratic Party has not offered any meaningful response to climate change itself. We have to, as a society, deal with the reality, which is we're going to have to put a cap on carbon. And no one in the Democratic Party is going to argue for that, because that means talking about the end of a belief in economic growth that can go on forever. All of these things are should be front and center in our political dialogue, and none of them are. So, you know, you can make an argument that just as dangerous to the planet as Donald Trump is Al Gore, a former vice president who runs around the country telling us all that if we just all adopt solar energy, we're going to save ourselves. And what Al Gore and that wing of the Democratic Party is unwilling to admit is that we're looking at a radical shift in the way we live. To quote one writer, we all are stuck in living arrangements that have no future. Okay, so all of this should be on the table. Now, I'm not really equating Donald Trump and Al Gore. I think they're both dangerous political figures, but one is far more dangerous. And the consequences in the short term of Donald Trump are, of course, far more dire. To go back to your point, how do you make a move toward reasoned dialogue with people who are committed to a kind of unreasoned engagement? And it may be that this just has to run its course, and we have to wait for elections to at least put back into power the less crazy wing of the American establishment, that is the Democratic Party. You've got basically a crazy political establishment, the borderline lunatic Republican Party and the only, you know, slightly deranged Democratic Party. Okay, that's what we're dealing with. It's not a pretty picture, but at least I think we should acknowledge that's where we sit.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Jensen, a professor at the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, and the author of Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream and Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. So there you are in a red state, the reddest of red states. You basically, the state's being run by a right-wing talk show host. who's, you know, by the way, Mike Pence was a right-wing talk show host too, and he may end up running the country. But the point I wanted to make was that you know, Austin is a kind of little blue island in a red state. Is there the effect of this little island of reason and rationality in that state being able to reach out to the rest of the state? Is there any kind of transaction there? In other words, can people talk across the fence to their neighbors and say, well, you know, you may be getting all your information from Fox News and Sinclair and mega churches, but, you know, there's this other alternative news here as well.
Yeah. So. Well, here, you know, again, I don't have a lot of sunny good news to offer you. In California, it may seem like Texas is crazy, and the reason it does is because Texas is crazy. So this, as you pointed out, one of the most powerful political figures in the state right now is the Lieutenant Governor, Dan Patrick, who is a former right-wing talk show host and the leader of the Tea Party wing of the Republicans. Here, basically, we have a Republican Party split between the moderate Republicans in today's world, which means reactionary right-wing business people, who want to continue to keep Texas basically a third world country in some ways, incredible concentration of wealth at the top, and basically a internal third world, a population that has very little access to services. And then you've got the Tea Party crowd that wants basically the same thing, but has a ideological fanaticism attached to it that's a little more dangerous in a lot of ways. That's the state. Now, I get students at the University of Texas from all over the state who come with various backgrounds, and over the course of time, when they're exposed to a variety of opinions, you can see some of them start to change. They shift from the ideology they brought in. It doesn't mean they all become, you know, leftist revolutionaries. It means that they're open to that critical engagement. The problem, of course, is that takes place over years with the resources of a university in play. When Austin goes out to try to affect the politics of Texas, it essentially is rejected, no matter what the issue, on the assumption that Austin is, you know, a communist redoubt. So it takes a simple thing. Austin City Council passed a ban on single-use plastic bags, which is very good for ecosystems, you know, less plastic floating around in all sorts of places. The state legislature overrides these kinds of local initiatives, even when they're very thoughtful, essentially reversing the general conservative notion that government should take place at the lowest possible level. That's a standard conservative talking point. You want the people at the local level to govern. Well, that's always the case unless the city of Austin is doing something progressive, in which case the state legislature overrides it with a statewide law. We saw that on the plastic bag ban. We saw it on attempts by Austin to regulate Uber and Lyft the same way that we regulate taxi cabs, a very sensible project, which is going to be overridden at the state level. The city of Denton, another kind of liberal redoubt up in North Texas, passed a ban on fracking. That was overridden by the state. So the state of Texas is now completely dominated not only by Republicans, but by reactionary Republicans. There is not a single statewide office held by a Democrat at this point. It's a grim story here, and, you know, we can hope that Texas is not going to be the model for the entire United States. Clearly, that's not the case. But there's a lot of disturbing aspects to the politics here, and Austin apparently has no impact on trying to deepen the dialogue.
So today, Trump at the Coast Guard Academy basically blamed all of his problems on the press and on, an unseen, unstated kind of deep state force out there that's out to do him in doing his presidency. And he called upon his people to rally behind him and that he was not going to quit and he was going to fight all the way. So he obviously feels besieged. They don't believe anything that's going on. They don't believe Comey. They don't believe all of this stuff that is the headlines now in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal. It's as though none of that counts. You know, you've got Fox, you've got Alex Jones. Fox's headlines are about some young guy that worked for the DNC who was murdered, and they're trying to say that the Clintons murdered him, just like going back to Vince Foster. You know, that's a headline. At the moment when you've got all the, you know, everybody in a lather over the Comey memo, that's what Fox is putting out. So you're not giving us the sense that there's anything that's going to bridge the gap there.
I, quite frankly, in the short term, I don't see anything that can. Let's talk about journalism a bit, because there's been a consistent left critique of the corporatization of journalism, of the way that journalism, especially on economic and foreign affairs, tends to follow elite opinion. There's a lot of very good analysis of the problem of mainstream journalism from the left. But now we're dealing with a situation where mainstream journalism, which is part of a democratic society and whatever its flaws is important, is under a more consistent and sustained assault from the right, which is, to me, very dangerous. So I think, first of all, those of us on the left have to both hold this notion that there are problems with the model of mainstream journalism in the U.S. I've been a critic for most of my adult life, but also recognize we need to support mainstream journalism because it is part of a democratic society. So that said, because mainstream journalism is not often spoken to ordinary people in this country and spoken to their interests, there was a whole component of the American population ready to abandon it completely. Fox pioneered the model to do it. Online websites like Drudge continued to push it. We're, again, stuck in a place that is not the product of the last election. It's the product of decades of an atrophying of democracy. It's kind of ironic that the post-World War II era, which saw the United States rise to unparalleled prominence in the world, also in a lot of ways sowed the seeds of the erosion of democracy. If we could go back and shift the way the American press developed in the 20th century to more of a European model, if we could go back and actually create meaningful public media back in the early years of television, you can go back and see all sorts of things that would have produced a journalism in this case that would have been more supportive of democracy, and now we're stuck. You know, there are a lot of these questions where it would be nice to say, well, here's the solution, but the problems are rooted in decades, sometimes centuries, of, you know, systems of concentrated power that are not going to be shifted soon. And unfortunately, I don't think either of the major political forces, the Democrats or the Republicans, really have the capacity to deal with this. Even the so-called left edge of the Democratic Party, somebody like Bernie Sanders, doesn't seem to be able to formulate the new kind of vision. At best, on the left edge of the Democrats, we say a kind of holding action to try and restore basically New Deal politics, far superior to the politics we're dealing with today, of course. But I think it's time for some really new thinking, and part of that just means recognizing that we are in a hole that is so deep that digging out of it, you know, really isn't perhaps the goal. We have to figure out how to live in the hole. It's a bit of a tortured metaphor, I admit, right. But that may be what we're dealing with these days.
Well, just in the last minute then, so it makes more sense, in effect, to fight the good fight against. And it's worth noting that the person who's really done more damage to the American media than any other single human being on the face of the earth, and it includes damage to the entire global media, is the person that Donald Trump speaks to more often than anybody else every day, and that is Rupert Murdoch, the owner
Absolutely.
Of Fox. So those two are tied at the hip. So we're better off not thinking that we can reach across and convince people to think Trump is doing a great job. What we have to do is do what we can to stop these two, right? Trump and Murdoch. Is that
right? If we were going to reduce politics to bumper stickers, there are two goals. One is to stop the worst of the assault on basic freedoms and the stability of the United States. The second is to not recover some old vision of the world, but start to build a new one, the kind of thing that can be attractive to people, that will get people excited. And that's a project we need to, that it's about creation. It's not about returning. It's about something new. And I think that's where the real energy is going to have to be put.
Well, Robert Jensen, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Always great to be with you, Ian. Thanks.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Jensen, a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. He is the author of Writing Dissent, Taking Radical Ideas from the Margins to the Mainstream, and Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was